What is up, you beautiful people? Welcome back to the Built on Bitcoin podcast, where we cover everything going on in the Bitcoin ecosystem. This is your home for Bitcoin innovation. So we're talking to the builders, the founders, the movers and shakers that are trying to unleash Bitcoin in all of its facets. I'm your humble host, Jacob Brown, but you'll see me around as Jake Blockchain. And today, I have a fantastic conversation with Trevor Owens. Trevor is the managing partner at Stax Ventures, which, as the name sounds, is a venture arm inside the Stax ecosystem that funds Stax startups. And we cover a ton in this conversation. We talk about Stax, the Bitcoin thesis. We talk about his background, what he did before he was an investor. He has a great response for my typical last question of the podcast of, if you couldn't fail, you've just been executing perfectly, you know, what does 5 years from now look like? And he gave us his ultimate dream goal and what his kind of life's mission is, which I thought was a fantastic response, the answer he gave. So we cover a ton, the Stax token stuff that's been going on, Bitcoin maxis a little bit here and there. So yeah, you don't want to miss this one. Highly, highly recommend, especially if you're a builder and you're interested in trying to get a leg up and some actionable insight. This one's for you. So let's jump in. But first, real quick, a word from our sponsor.
We all know Bitcoin is for the innovators, the revolutionaries, and the builders looking to build a better world for themselves and for the next generation. We also know the saying, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The next best time is right now. The same thing applies to building on Bitcoin. If you want to come build with the most active developer community building new use cases for Bitcoin, then it's time you make the leap to learning Clarity. Clarity is the Stax smart contract programming layer, which enables us to work on DeFi, smart contracts, and so much more, all built with the safety and security that comes with Bitcoin. Start today by going to start.stax.org. Start.stax.org has a five-step journey that will take you from complete Stax novice to teaching you Clarity, all the way to finding a job with a Web3 Stax startup. Don't wait another month, year, or decade waiting to get involved in the Bitcoin ecosystem. Start building on Bitcoin today. Go to start.stax.org to start learning and building today.
All right. So thank you to the Stax Foundation. Now, without further ado, cue the sexy segue music.
Welcome to Built on Bitcoin.
Trevor, how you doing today, my man?
Good, man. How about you?
I am a little sleepy, but super, super excited to have you on. There's a ton to talk about. You're a figure in the Stax space. I'm not even sure where to dance around at first, but maybe for people that aren't aware of Trevor, what's a little bit of your background?
Yeah, so I'm the managing partner of Stax Ventures. My background is as an entrepreneur, advisor to startup companies, as a developer as well. So I got started about 15 years ago, building companies since I was in university. My first business was actually importing scooters from China to the US. If you kind of Google my scooter story, it was actually a failure that led to my next venture, which was going around the world teaching people about lean startup, which is about how to validate your startup ideas before you build them and invest too much time and money in them. And so I met up with the author of the Lean Startup, Eric Ries, before he wrote the book. He was sort of like a mentor to me. I learned a lot from him, as well as from many other people in the Lean Startup community, like Brent Cooper, who we've actually brought into the accelerator, about this customer development process. And I created one of the largest grassroots organized startup training camps called Lean Startup Machine that we did in something like 150 cities around the world. And, you know, we created a bunch of tools. I worked with Gray Singh, who's the creator of CrashPunk. She's my co-founder, and she did all, like, you know, all the branding for Lean Startup Machine and ran a lot of the workshops. And, we consulted with some of the largest Fortune 500 companies in the world, like GE, American Express, you name it, Microsoft. Like if there's a company, if there's a Fortune 500 company doing like innovation or tech, they've been probably been through my training camp. And I also went over to China and started teaching innovation to Huawei and Tencent, which was a very interesting experience. And along the way, I advised, you know, hundreds of founders around the world. One of the founders that I worked more closely with was the founders of Stack. So Ryan Hsieh and Manib Ali, when they were getting off the ground, it was originally they went through multiple iterations. You know, I met them when they were literally just first getting started. I had known Ryan for a while, and he introduced me to Manib, and the beginning they were even talking about doing, you know, medical health records. And they got into when Bitcoin started getting popular in 2012, they went all in on it. They were the reason I first bought Bitcoin. I had over 100 Bitcoin at one point. Sold it all when it was going down on the over the years, you know, was just very impressed by everything they were doing. I was continuing to basically build software and launch products in the startup space, so helping entrepreneurs start startups, launch about 5 different products, trying to help entrepreneurs use a lean startup method to launch their businesses, various successes, levels of success. Nothing that was a home run or slam dunk or a sort of a blockbuster product. And you know, I built a lot of the products myself, full stack in mainly in Ruby on Rails, but I also love Elixir. Phoenix is a program for me I really like. With respect to Ninja Alerts, which is also in addition to Stack's Ventures, I also run Ninja Alerts, which is an NFT alerts tool that allows you to follow wallets on Ethereum and get alerts when people are buying, minting, or selling different NFTs. You know, we built that in Node and React, so I'm pretty well versed in the technology side. And I approached sort of the team at Stack's when they first launched Stack's 2.0. I'm still had my advisor token allocation. I haven't sold a single one of those. In fact, my Stack's stake is much higher than my, you know, original advisor share now, because I flipped a ton of NFTs on Ethereum and then reinvested a lot of that back into Stack's. And so I approached them when they launched Stack's 2.0, and you know, they, I was actually building accelerator management software, and they were like, "Oh, we need someone to run our accelerator. Can you, you know, we don't need the software, but can you just run the accelerator for us?" And so that's how kind of we got started. Put together a great team, of which Jake, you're part of. You know, Kyle, my partner. We have Andrea, Francisco, and now Nikita on the team, and we've invested in 45 companies in the Stack's ecosystem. I've made some investments myself outside of Stack's, mainly in companies run by friends of mine or things that are strategic for what I'm doing in the NFT space. And I'm just super, of course, Stack's maxi and passionate about Stack's and Bitcoin. And I see value in everything that's being built in Web3. And that was a big shift for me in, you know, a year ago. I would say I went from being a complete skeptic to a complete believer in a very short time.
When you started that, you mentioned the scooter story, which there's an interesting video you can watch on that one. And it kind of shows some of the lean startup methodology about validating your ideas, MVPs, this kind of thing. But when you think about entrepreneurship, actually, maybe to lead into this, were you entrepreneurial as a kid?
Not really. I think as a kid, I was mainly like a nerd. I mean, I did coding when I was a kid. I think, you know, in high school, I took like 4 years of coding. I was lucky that my school even had it. I think it's kind of rare looking back at, I mean, maybe it's more popular today, but not many schools even offered programming courses. I was really good at that. I was really good at computers, but mainly a gamer. I did when I was in, I think before high school, like middle school, I started my own guild, my own guild on Diablo 2. That's the most entrepreneurial thing I did, but it really came down to when I was in high school, and I wasn't even that really ambitious of a kid, to be honest. I guess I was kind of ambitious, but what really motivated me, like I was ambitious in athletics. So like I was captain of the wrestling team in high school. I was, ranked number one my senior year. I ended up getting injured, and that was a big turning point for me because it was a kind of a point of suffering. Like I lost my identity. My girlfriend broke up with me at the time, my first girlfriend. And that sort of made me really ambitious. And I happened to be a part of this high school program called Future Business Leaders of America. I don't know if it's still around today, but basically, I went to high school in New Hampshire. And so what I did was every summer I would like compete in a programming competition and I basically won. So I won the state in this Future Business of America. They had like a C++ programming competition and, I competed in the C++ one, and I think I got second, or I can't remember. And then I also there was a web design competition. I won first in that, or maybe I got second in the Visual Basic. I think I won like second and first twice or something like that. And then they would pay for me to go to this like national conference, and that was a lot of fun. And there'd be like motivational speakers there who would talk about like, you know, how to start your own business and like sort of like Tony Robbins type stuff. And that sort of really got me interested in starting businesses. And then I started my first web design company like in high school, and then leading into university, started the scooter company. I was going to go to Wall Street because I went to NYU Stern for undergrad, and then decided that I didn't want to do that. And then got into, actually had this fantastic professor named Larry Lenihan, who is a venture capitalist in New York City at NYU. He had invested in like Pinterest and Second Market, which was what Barry Silbert, the founder of DCG, his previous company. And like, it was this amazing course. A friend of mine, I almost didn't sign up for it. A friend of mine basically, because I was studying Chinese, and I met this kid at the, when I transferred to NYU, you have to like take a placement test to like figure out what level your Chinese is. So I met this kid, Mel, who became a good friend. And I was like, what course are you taking? He's like, I'm taking this entrepreneurship course. This professor looks like Gordon Gekko. He has like a 3-piece suit. And so this is Larry Lenihan. If anybody knows him, you'll take a laugh. But in that class, basically, the founder of Chainlink was my project partner. So Sergey Nazarov took the class with him. Actually, Mimel and Sergey started a company in Larry's class. And then I think it was the next year, Kyle Samani, who founded Multi-Chain Capital, Multi-Coin Capital. Anyway, he's like one of the biggest crypto VCs right now, big Solana guy. He was in the next class. So it's kind of like, I don't know what my point is, but just kind of telling my story, been through an interesting journey here. And it actually was Larry who really, you know, was the reason why I didn't go to Wall Street, because he always said, the older you get, the harder it becomes to start a business. Like you get a mortgage, you get kids, like you have more risk. Like the best time to start a business is like, even when you're younger, you don't know anything, you're inexperienced. It's actually much better to start a business then than trying to go like to the corporate world and like then start a business later, because you're going to have more risk. And so he was always like, if you have an idea, you should start now. And if you're in your 20s and you fail, like that's actually like fine. Like, you know, it's much better to fail in your 20s, and that might suck, but you know, at least in your 30s, you'll know exactly what to do. And actually that's kind of exactly where I'm at now in my life, because, you know, I had all these different, launched so many different products, and like some of them were pretty successful, but nothing super successful. But the lessons that I learned along the way, super priceless. And, you know, my goal with Stax Ventures is really to save all of the founders that we invest in from making the same mistakes that I made. So I think that's part of the value that we bring to the table.
The amount of people I've seen who have learned some amount of entrepreneurship through gaming, like RuneScape for me, or WoW, or Diablo, like you learn about the free market and how to sell and all these different things, like the value of maybe holding now and reading the market, all these different things. But you mentioned entrepreneurship is kind of a young man's game, is like how it's touted. And entrepreneurship is also kind of in vogue in the past decade or so. Like everyone says they want to do it. Do you think that in the broad landscape of just like people working jobs, is entrepreneurship for most people?
I think it's for everyone, but I think, I don't particularly think it's a young man's game. I think actually the vast majority of successful entrepreneurs are in their 40s. And the average successful entrepreneur, I think they have like 12 years of work experience. If you look at like brick and mortar businesses, 13 years. If for like a tech, it's like 12 years. But the difference is like if you start young, like that's the fastest way to develop yourself as an entrepreneur. You know, and of course, like talent plays into it a little bit. You know, like I wouldn't be a very good basketball player. You know, I'm not tall enough. You know, I don't have the sort of the DNA, but I think in terms of entrepreneurship, you know, anybody can do it. And I think what we're seeing with the creator economy is that more people are doing it. And so it doesn't mean like to be an entrepreneur doesn't mean that you need to be, you know, the next Jeff Bezos or, you know, Elon Musk. That's pretty unrealistic, I think. You know, maybe no one will be the next Elon Musk. You know, there'll be like one person, you know, but anybody can start something from nothing. Anybody can take an idea and bring it to life. And we're becoming better at explaining how that actually works and teaching entrepreneurship as like a form of management. That's kind of the vision of Lean Startup. As Eric Ries's original vision was like Lean Startup, the goal is to turn the art of entrepreneurship into a management discipline. Just like 100 years ago, there was no MBA school. You know, there was no idea of like modern management 100 years ago. And so you look back, you know, 20 years ago compared to what we know now about how to build startups, it's completely night and day different. And we have much more best practices and frameworks that can allow anybody to, you know, work on a project. And whether that be, like you said, you're trying to build the next Amazon, or whether it's you're trying to build an NFT community, or you're trying to build an open source project. You know, entrepreneurship is a skill that's valuable for everybody, you know, whether you're an artist, a developer, or no matter what you want to do. If you want to work in a big company, you need to know understand innovation and entrepreneurship, because more and more big companies are facing the innovator's dilemma and struggling to keep up with just the rapid pace of change that we're going through as a society and in the marketplace. So I think that everybody should at least dabble in entrepreneurship in their lives.
Yeah, I've definitely felt that. There's like a switch to go from being a consumer to a producer. Like it's kind of worldview shift where you're kind of looking for things that you can create or white space that it currently exists that isn't being served by the market. When you look at a good founder, what are the kind of like characteristics or personality traits that make that like top tier founder that people can kind of like work on themselves and build?
I think the most important thing is rationality. So the ability to understand cognitive biases and sort of overcome them, the ability to make good judgment and good decisions. I think judgment is by far the most important thing in a good founder, but the cool thing is that your judgment can improve over time. I mean, the more experience that you become, the more you learn, and your judgment improves from experience. And so you need to have work ethic, determination, drive. I would say the first most important thing, though, is that adaptability and rationality around, you know, being able to make good decisions based on data and intuition and taking feedback and listening to people who know what they're, you know, who are giving valuable feedback. Also just coachability. So, you know, if you have like too much drive and determination and not enough flexibility, like you're almost guaranteed to fail because you're just going to go in the wrong direction and keep driving and being super stubborn. But if you can mix that drive and determination with the intellectual and strategic flexibility and that sort of level of rationality, then, you know, you're going to be super successful at some point, like whether it's this business or the next business. Staying intellectually humble and being driven, and also I think being guided by a higher purpose, you're gonna bring a lot of value into the world.
Perfect. Okay, I'm gonna take a slight left turn, move us into crypto land a little bit, and I want to start with, you wrote a Medium post in 2013 titled "Why Bitcoin Won't Be a Bubble." And yeah. It's crazy. There's certain things you read, like when you read the Bezos shareholder letters, especially like the ones in like the late 90s, they feel like this is Amazon in the sense of like everything he said 20 years ago is exactly, he just perfect vision, execution, but he had the right mindset from the jump. But it's funny, as like a little time capsule to read this, because the first line says, as Bitcoin's reached mass market awareness, a debate has erupted as to whether Bitcoin is a bubble or a world-changing technology, especially that first piece of like, it's crossed the chasm almost a decade ago. Feels yeah. weird. It feels like we're still just crossing the chasm.
Yeah.
But I'm curious for you, what do you find so fascinating about the crypto space?
Yeah, man, I totally forgot I wrote that. That's really funny. So, I mean, my original hypothesis around Bitcoin was simply around remittances, an alternative to Western Union. I thought, you know, I really look at the use cases. I really look at what are people doing with it? Is there value for end users? A technology has no value without market application. And so I don't care what the technology is unless people can get value out of it. You know, the market cap of the technology is going to be based on the total sum number of users and the value that's created, right? And the value that then can be captured by the business model, right? So with Bitcoin, you know, it's like, well, it was pretty obvious in 2013. It's like the Chinese government is, you know, restricting capital from flowing out of the country. And there's lots of billionaires there and there's lots of wealthy people, you know, 2 billion people, right? I guess it's actually, was it 1.4? Okay. But you get the idea, like there's a lot of money that goes through remittances, and Bitcoin as a technology in 2013 was like a really good means to do that. And so, you know, what I was looking at was like, I looked at a report that actually Barry Silbert put out in DCG talking about, you know, if Bitcoin was to capture the remittance market, then the market cap would be like $3,000 per coin, right? And so like that's kind of like what I estimated, and that's why I like started buying when it was like $100, and I bought a ton of it, and then it got up to like $1,000, and I bought on the way up, and then got to $1,000, and then China like banned it being used in remittances, and then you saw like the value like plummet from there. And for me, you know, when I saw 2017 ICOs, I was like, listen, I live in the world of like reality of like building a business. And I, most of the stuff I do with Lean Startup is like talking to founders and sort of crushing their dreams back into reality by, you know, in a constructive way of helping them understand what it actually takes to be successful and what they need to do to be successful and why their ideas aren't going to work if you can't get anybody to use it. And so when I saw like the 2017 ICO craze and you see companies raising like, you know, tens of millions of dollars without anything built, it's like, this is madness and this is stupid. And so I stayed very clear away from it at that point. And then coming back into the 2020 cycle, that was when I first saw DeFi and NFTs, and I saw people actually using it, and I saw that there are real applications being built on top of Ethereum and other blockchains other than Bitcoin. And that was when I finally believed that this would be something. And then I worked backwards to understanding the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum and how decentralized Bitcoin is, how politically neutral it is. And that's when I really saw the value in Stack specifically, because nothing will ever be created again that will be like Bitcoin in the sense that it'll be politically neutral, that it'll be so decentralized. But then on the other hand, with Ethereum, they've actually proven that real people are going to get value out of this more so than just being, you know, a collective delusion of money, right? Not that there's any problem with that. I'm not trying to say that's a bad thing, but there's a big difference between a new internet and a new computing platform and the potential that can be built on top of that with, you know, DAOs and new forms of governance and new forms of ownership than just, you know, solving the double spend problem, you know, through Bitcoin. It's not to minimize Bitcoin, because the fact that Ethereum is working and can work proves to me that Bitcoin will come full circle and has the potential to become a globally, to become the world's money. And so I think that maybe that's a little bit different take than how some people think, but, you know, I went from being like, okay, like I see the value of Bitcoin, but, you know, how are we going to make this collective delusion work to really accept this as a global form of money? And then when I saw that actually so much more can be used on top of this, that this can actually be something that every single person on the earth has to use, not even just for money alone, but for things that cannot be built through the normal paradigm of building software, then I worked back into it that, hey, this is really going to make it, and that this is going to be far bigger than anybody else expected. And with Stacks, building that on top of Bitcoin, to me, seems like way more valuable than doing on top of Ethereum.
Yeah, I've heard you. I was watching your past interview with Brian Harrington. Shout out to Brian. And I think, especially Bitcoin maxis, they understand the money part of it. Like Bitcoin is a store of value. It's won that narrative. We won't talk about the ETH ultrasound. Like that's tomfoolery. But you mentioned something about the block space might be the most valuable thing about Bitcoin, kind of alluding to like it might not just be the BTC that's the thing, it's the ledger, it's the settlement layer. And I think that's where a lot of people who still haven't kind of grokked Web3, they don't put enough weight on that. What do you think that they're missing? What do you think will be the unlock? Because you've had that transformation where you were like, I was skeptical, now I'm fully bought in. It's where we're going. What are they missing?
Yeah, I just don't think they ever think about building software, you know what I'm saying? Or like building apps, you know, like I think the vast majority of Bitcoiners, first of all, are not developers. Like the ratio of developers in the Stacks community, I mean, in the Ethereum community compared to Bitcoin, it's like way more developers in the Ethereum community, in terms of like the actual users of the network. And then in Stacks, it's obviously even higher. But I just think like the vast majority of people that are not developers, they don't know anything about software. They don't think about building products. And then I think the ones that are developers, you know, they're more, you know, they're not really like the entrepreneurial type developers. Like they're not thinking about like, you know, what future innovative technology can I build? Like they're more sort of like hardcore engineers, where it's like, you know, there's like engineers where it's like all they care about is like, how can I reduce how can I make this server respond as fast as possible? Like, how can I reduce this from like 10 milliseconds to 9 milliseconds by like changing my code to, you know, to do this? Or, you know, I mean, I've hired a lot of developers for my different companies, and they're great engineers, they're great developers, but they don't think big picture. They miss sort of the forest for the trees. And so I think there's a lot of developers in the Bitcoin community who, the ones who don't understand Web3, like they're really focused on the trees, they're not looking at the forest. And then everybody else who's against it, like they just don't know anything about software. And so you're starting to see actually a lot more of the developers, like Matt Corallo, who was like a Bitcoin core developer for a long time. They're coming out here and they're being like, listen, like this maxi, toxic maxi stuff is bullshit. And it's incumbent upon us as a Bitcoin community, if we're going to even survive, to look at what's happening in Ethereum and take the best practices that we can from them, study our competition, know them better than they know themselves, and then apply those things back to what we're doing, rather than just sort of like put our head in the sand and be like, oh, it's bullshit. You know, like, it's like, you know, a very childish reaction to sort of just dismiss your competition. Instead, you should know your competition better than they know themselves. You know, keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. Not to say that Bitcoin and Ethereum are enemies. I think that they are very complementary, but they are competition. So I think that's like, from my perspective, Bitcoin is not guaranteed to make it. Like, you know, the Nazis could have won World War II. You know, Russia could, the Soviet Union could have been the first one to land on the moon. You know, the good guys don't always win. the fact that Bitcoin is so decentralized and so politically neutral, probably 80% of the world doesn't care. Like 80% of the users out there, they only care about like the actual, like using the product, right? Like people use Facebook every day. They don't care that Mark Zuckerberg is stealing all your data and, you know, monetizing your private information, you know, to the extent that he can. People still use it. And so we need to be very vigilant to protect and make sure that Bitcoin succeeds. And if Ethereum or, you know, if Ethereum, not trying to paint Ethereum as the bad guy here, but, you know, another chain gets way more users and way more usage, and that chain is not decentralized like Bitcoin and not neutral in the way that Bitcoin is, Bitcoin could lose. And that would be a huge loss to the world and to society. And so it's incumbent upon us to implement the best of Web3 on top of Bitcoin so that Bitcoin can continue its hegemony and be the number one chain so that we can have the neutrality and decentralization of Bitcoin.
Yeah, there's something weird about the Bitcoin community where they're just, it's like they almost feel like there's already so much momentum that I can just take my foot off the gas and like this train's going to go. It's like we went to the moon in the 60s or whatever, and then there was like a period of like nothing until Elon hops back on that train. And maxis are like the, we're going to go to Mars just from the 60s launch. Like I'm just going to sit here and we're good to go. We're going to get there anyways. I don't think people realize that it takes that consistent effort over time by everyone, the entire community. And Ethereum is this perfect like experimentation basket that we can just pluck cherries from and put them over here.
I mean, you know, shout out to Tom who created MySpace. I think he follows Stacks. He actually follows me on Twitter. But you know, like, hey, we could have had Tom from MySpace. He seems like a great guy. He probably wouldn't be, you know, monetizing and stealing our data like Zuckerberg. But instead we have Zuckerberg. So, you know, the good guys don't always win.
That's right. Okay, so speaking of good guys, Muneeb and Brian they're working on something on Bitcoin way back, and thankfully they, you know, through their journey have created this new thing trying to unleash Bitcoin. But I'm curious about that kind of origin story. So how did you get connected to them, and what was the first kind of meetings like when you met Muneeb and Ryan?
Yeah, so I met Ryan at a incubator space called Dogpatch Labs in New York City. It was like the first co-working space incubator in the New York tech scene. This is like 2000, maybe 11, maybe no, maybe 2010. Anyway, I was actually intern for the venture capital fund that ran the space, Polaris Ventures, and Ryan was also an intern there. Ryan's a couple years younger than me, and we just kind of hit it off and started like going to different tech events together and made some mutual friends. Ryan helped me organize this meetup that we did called the Student New York Tech Meetup in the summer, which was like the New York Tech Meetup in New York is like huge. There's like, you know, 2,000 people that attend. And I was organizing like the student group. So we had like students from, you know, all the different New York City schools, Princeton, Harvard, you know, Columbia, NYU, et cetera, in sort of the Northeast region. And he was helping me organize that. And then, a couple of years go by, I was doing the Lean Startup Machine thing. We, kept in good touch with Ryan, always a super, super smart person and just great guy. And then he had met Muneeb at Princeton, I think through the computer science group and through the entrepreneurship group. And then, Ryan just like basically, we had lunch together one day. He's like, this is Muneeb and, you know, we're doing this thing, you know, we're trying to start a business. You know, I've been doing all this lean startup stuff. So he's like asking my advice on how to go to market and how to validate their ideas. And then, I think it was like a year goes by. I had actually just raised, about $2 million for my company for a lean startup machine to build software. And, they were moving offices. I was like, oh, like, let me give you guys, like, there's two desks in my office, you know, you can come take it. And so they moved up and were working out of my office for a little bit. And then they started raising money, and I was just sort of like coaching Ryan on how to raise capital, just like I do in the accelerator. A lot of the same tactics and fun lessons that I impart on all of our portfolio founders. They raised money super quickly. They got into Y Combinator. You know, I helped with their application, like rewriting their applications. Like I write emails for our founders. And from there, I mean, I wasn't that involved after that, but I was just kind of there at that really beginning start where they're raising their first round, and was helpful with that. And yeah, they went on to raise from some of the best investors in the world and build a great, fantastic team. And I was just always impressed over the years at, you know, their judgment and their great timing. You know, Muneeb and Ryan always had great timing with things. I think that they tried a lot of things that didn't work as well. You know, like when you look at like what the previous thing was called Blockstack, right? And so Blockstack was no token, just decentralized identity and storage, which is now, you know, Gaia storage and sort of has evolved also into BNS. They tried to do a lot of the things that the Maxis are doing now for many years to turn into a business. And I think eventually they realized when they saw Ethereum taking off that, like, okay, like, you know, they kind of came around to like, here's why we need a token, here's a technological reason. And that's when they decided to launch Stax at that point. So, you know, they've been in this industry for the longest time. And actually, when I first met them, when they were first getting to Bitcoin, like, they were the only people I knew in the New York scene who actually had read the source code of Bitcoin. So like, when I was talking about Bitcoin, you know, I was like very skeptical. Actually, my CTO at the time was like, using Bitcoin to buy things on the dark web, you know, let's say, I won't say too much more than that, but you know, that's how like other people I knew were using it. And I was talking to Ryan Muneeb and they were like, oh no, like this is how it works. And like, they were so in depth on like how it actually worked that I was like, oh man, this could really be something. So that kind of got me into it. Unfortunately, I didn't stay into it, you know, lessons learned, but that's why time travel is the most powerful superpower. Because if you could just time travel back to 2010, you know, anybody could be a trillionaire now.
100%. The Y Combinator application, were they applying with Blockstack at that time?
It was actually called one name at that point. So this is before Blockstack. I think they rebranded to Blockstack after Y Combinator. And so one name was just decentralized identity on the blockchain. You know, what they did was they launched, if you like Google like one name, you'll see some old screenshots. You'll see like an old picture of me on the landing page. And they, it was just a way to like register your basically like BNS, you know, it was basically like ENS or BNS before that existed. And they created a little landing page, just like, it was very actually like lean startup oriented. Like they created a landing page and they had people register and they like sent it out through social media. And then they got like all of these like top Silicon Valley VCs to register their domain name on it. It's such a simple, like one feature product. You know what I'm saying? It's what I always tell people, like one feature, like build a product that's one feature. If you can do that and you've identified with the killer features, you build one feature, that's the fastest way to be successful. That's literally what they did with one name. They built one feature, like just register your name. And then they got Barry Silbert, you know, from DCG to register his name, Naval Ravikant to register a name. All the VCs registered their names. And then that's how they raised their round, like overnight, because people were using their product. And when VCs see other VCs using a product, they get super FOMO. So it was very clever and it was very lean, and they validated the product and raised capital in one go. And then it later became Blockstack, where they started to think about, you know, adding decentralized storage into there. And so, you know, it's kind of funny. Blockstack could have been ENS, it could have been IPFS, but finally it's become Stax. And I think that in the end it'll all be worth it, and Stax could be something bigger than both of those combined.
Very cool. Okay, I'm going to take another left turn. I want to make sure we cover Stax Ventures for a little pocket. So first, before we jump into that, in your definition, because like, I'm learning as I go, I had an image of what VCs did But that's been eroding over time. They're very busy. I used to think like you guys just kind of like sit in a room and you just pluck out good companies and you write checks and they just wait. And it's like, it is what it is. Yeah,
that's what the later stage VCs do. That's not what, you know, the accelerators, yeah. We're really busy, but you know, once we graduate, you know, then I'll be at the golf course, you know, just chilling.
Basically retired. Yeah. So in your mind, what is a properly working VC do? What does that entail?
I mean, I think it's easy to, you know, kind of punch up against VCs. They're kind of easy target. I think you know, there's typically three roles in a VC fund. So you typically have partners with different specializations. And there's kind of three different specializations that a VC firm needs. So one is investor relations. And so that includes meeting with LPs and networking with other VCs. That's like one sort of full-time, you know, thing is like, some people are good at that, some people aren't good at that. The next thing is like operating. So actually working hands-on with companies and like helping them to run their business and, you know, and helping them be more successful, right? That's another role of a VC. The third role is then deal making. So actually getting into deals. So being able to meet a founder, convince them to work with you, convince them to take your money, work out a deal, get into the best deals. So those are the three roles a VC needs to have. I think typically most VCs are, you know, better at the first and third one. You know, they don't typically tend to be as good at the operating one, and the operating one probably gets the least credit because really, actually, I think the most important one is just the deal making, right? Like if you can be good with, but it requires also investor relations skills, but probably the most important skill of VC is like being buddies with founders. You know, you may have no redeeming quality at all. You may know nothing. You may have no experience, no knowledge, no skills. But if you can make deals with founders, you can generate good returns as a VC. And so that's sort of the unfortunate reality of life and venture capital.
And so when you say deal making, that's like being able to actually close, cut the check. Because if it's like the, what do they say? It's like default alive kind of thing. Like you need to have the money to sustain, to get over that chasm. Is that what you mean?
No, what I mean is that there's certain companies where it's so obvious. Like let's say like Jack Dorsey starts his next company. Okay. Everyone wants to invest in that. Okay. For these like really obvious, like what we do at the accelerator, we do Stacks Ventures is not really that. Like we're investing much earlier than that. Like somebody like, you know, like look at what Muneeb did, right? Like he raised 150 million, you know, off the jump for Trust Machines. Okay. Getting into rounds like that is what I mean by deal making, where it's like someone can get, you know, anyone they want to invest in it. You know what I mean? And VCs have to fight to get into it. You know, how are you going to get your, you know, your money in that round? Right. And so, you know, actually being a better operator really helps with that. Right. But it may not be like one for one related, right? Like just like, you know, when I was a wrestler, you know, I thought like going to the gym, like the more I can bench press, the better I'll do as a wrestler. But really actually just technique mattered the most, you know, just being really good at technique. Similar with deal making. If you're just really good at deal making, you know, maybe you don't know anything, you have no skill as an operator, but you can still get into the good deals. But what we do at Stacks Ventures, you know, like of course we will we're trying to invest in like the most competitive rounds as possible, but really we're building a competency for identifying the hidden gems, you know, the diamond in the rough. We're discovering undiscovered talent, and we're actually creating value as opposed to trying to be the last person on the bus. You know, we're trying to be the first check in and identify really good developers who other people don't know about and validate them and, you know, help them to fix maybe like one key thing with their company that's going to change them from being, you know, one of many to one of a kind.
So if you're a founder and you're intrigued by Stacks and you potentially be join the accelerator or get kind of in the purview of Stax Ventures, what are you looking for?
So I think the most important thing is like having a validated idea. Like if your idea is actually something that makes sense, it's going to work in the market, that has validation behind it and fits into the patterns of what we're seeing be really successful. So, you know, the pre-accelerator is a really good place to go. Albert is running a fantastic program there where it actually helps you to get feedback from all the different entities in the ecosystem and figure out something that is really needed to be built that can help, that's going to get traction and going to make be successful from the jump. You know, we're looking for founders who can find an easy way to do something difficult. So we're looking for not necessarily an obvious idea, but when you tell me this idea, it's fucking obvious. This is a brilliant idea and it's going to be make a lot of money and be really successful. Like we're looking for, and that your way to execute it is going to be very simple. And so it's kind of like, if you ask me to think of one of those ideas right now on the spot, I probably, you know, I could maybe think of one or two just because we're always meeting these ideas. But, you know, the bar for like having something that can be really successful really easily is like what we're looking for. And then just seeing that the team is complete so that you have the classic three roles that we look for in a team is, you know, the hustler, the hacker, and the hipster. So the hustler is that business founder who's going to be really successful at raising, who's charming, who can attract talent, who is resilient, you know, that's coachable and can do marketing and is like is able to go out there and be, we say, squeaky as a wheel. You know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, you know, tactfully and tastefully shameless out there promoting the business. And then the hacker, so you know, the blockchain engineer, the smart contract engineer, the backend guy who's going to really build some world-class intellectual property and technology that's going to be scalable and performant and you know, bring a lot of value. And then the hipster, who's the front end person, the person who's going to build the UI, the user interface, so that your users can actually use that backend technology and create a world-class product, whether it be a mobile app or a web app, that you're going to be competitive in the broader market. Because to be successful as a startup, the key is to do is less is more, to do as little as possible, but to be world-class in everything you do. And the only way to be world-class in everything you do is to do as little as possible. And so that's what's going to make you successful as a founder. That's what we're looking to invest in, because the bar for being successful is so high. It's so difficult and so challenging to be successful as an entrepreneur that you need to stack the deck in your favor. You know what I'm saying? You need to go to Vegas with the card counters from MIT and know that you have a hot hand coming up, because that's the only way to be successful. There's so many things that could go wrong and it's so difficult that I think unless you want to start like a lifestyle business or a small business or a consulting business, like those are much more easily to be successful because you're not going for venture capital style returns. To actually build a unicorn business, okay, we don't expect all of our founders to do that. Actually, we want our founders to have a lot of doubles and triples as exits, you know, as opposed to a unicorn. But even to do that, you know, you need everything in your favor. And it would be irresponsible of me to invest in something where we're setting a founder off on a path where they're going to only result in pain in their lives. Because I've failed. I've had a lot of things fail. And the thing that people don't talk about is it sucks and it's extremely painful. And it will literally take years off the end of your life and bring you to the edge of your own sanity. And that's not something that I wish on anybody. And so that's why I'm so strict when it comes to wanting founders to take every possible precaution in aligning their business to be successful.
Perfect. For founders listening, that I don't think that could be understated of the, it's like, you want someone like Trevor in your corner to give you short-term pain for long-term benefit. And I've seen it myself where, like, when you're on a call, especially when I first joined, I was like, man, this guy, he's kind of a jerk. Like, he's going hard right now. But over time, and I've seen you do it, like, you might call someone out in the community, but it's always, like, mission-driven. It's always, like, the greater goal is there. And so it's, like, the people that do give you that constructive criticism, especially when it's, like, unflinching, like, it's worth its weight in gold for sure, because the long-term pain of, you could have gotten good data, someone could have told you this thing to make you do a right instead of a left, is just, you can avoid so much heartache.
Yeah, man, and it's like, it's hard. It's hard work. Like, you know, it'd be much easier not to be, like, I try to be very delicate in being critical, right? But it's not fun. You know what I'm saying? It's not fun to be critical of founders, especially because, you know, I love founders so much. You know, I am a founder. But it's like sort of a moral responsibility to give your, you know, blunt and maybe unpleasant feedback all the time, because most VCs, they don't give any negative feedback. In fact, it doesn't benefit me as a VC to give any founder any negative feedback ever, because what I should do as a VC is just, like, sort of treat everybody like an option. You know what I'm saying? Like, sort of like some VCs, they take this perspective of, like, you know, I'm just a money allocator and I'm not going to have any impact on any business. Right. And so, and that's actually a pretty good strategy, because you're only going to pick the winners. You're not going to help create the winners. Right. And if you just pick the winners, well, then someone who you think, especially if you come from your VC comes from, like, a finance background or a background where you don't actually know how the sausage is made, you know, you could be talking to someone and think it's a dumb idea. A month later, they could be raising, you know, money from the best investors in the world. And so if you give them negative feedback, or you, like, tell them that they're wrong or try to argue with them, you're only hurting your chances of making a deal with them to get in the round later. Right. And so the vast majority of VCs just nod their heads and say, oh, that's great, I love it. In fact, when I raised money for my first company, I met with 100 VCs who all said, well, that's great, I love it. And not one of those 100 people actually invested. You know what I'm saying? They just nod their heads and then, like, great, do you want to invest? And they're like, yeah, let me get back to you. You know, I definitely want to, you know, let me get back to you. And so, you know, but I just feel like eventually the founders are going to look back on that and they're going to appreciate that, even if they maybe dislike me in the short term, or if I'm not able to deliver the feedback delicately enough. But at the same time, like, that's how I would want, you know, to be treated. And I try as a VC, I think it's our policy, it's not like, we never want to poo-poo on anybody. You know what I'm saying? We want to try to explain and try to offer advice and give perspective. And ultimately, we're not in the driver's seat. You know, it's not our company. We're just sharing our feedback and thoughts and a way that hopefully can benefit the founders.
Okay, I want to start to bring this to a close. I want to try a new style, maybe a rapid fire-ish session on some things that have been interesting to me in the crypto space, and just kind of, like, spitball your take on these. So, one of them is, we're seeing, you know, there's DALL-E now, which can create these amazing images, you know, out of thin air almost. More and more coding tools are coming along to make it easier to code. GitHub Copilot, no code tools. And so I'm seeing there's digital scarcity that blockchain kind of, like, brings, and then there's technical abundance that these tools keep layering on. How do you see that intersection? I know it's kind of a crazy big topic, but, like, I don't know how to wrestle with that idea. And so, like, as a VC, it seems interesting that landscape seems to be shifting. How do you view those two things, of digital scarcity and technical abundance tools coming online?
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, there are, what are you making me think of? I don't have a well-formed thought on this because you're just throwing this at me, but I think it's, you know, technology sort of happens on the edges, like at the extremes, right? So, it's fascinating. Digital scarcity. I mean, in some ways, you know, some ways we don't have pure digital scarcity. It's like really up to, you know, I mean, there's more and more NFTs out right there. There's more and more tokens and stuff like that, but it's more like digital scarcity in terms of like a flight to quality, right? And I think that the accessibility of the internet tends to lead to power law outcomes, right? So when anything is a click away, you know, people only go for the first and the best, right? So while there is a ton of abundance, we're also seeing a gravitation towards consolidation of power law distribution, of more inequality. You know what I'm saying? And so in today's world, like inequality is actually raising more and more, like polarization is increasing more and more. And I think it's just sort of we're in a society right now where, I guess, like most of the systems that we've known over the last 100 years are breaking down. Like capitalism is sort of breaking down in interesting ways, where we're seeing more inequality. And, you know, I don't know what the answer is, man, but I think that in a way, blockchain to me represents like more of a meritocracy. So with respect to DAOs, with respect to ownership, I think that the goal of Bitcoin, people say it's, which I agree with, is to separate money from the state, right? That's such a noble purpose. The goal of Web3 is to separate, you know, data and ownership from corporations to everyone, and to allow more people to have voice in our economy and with things that we own, right? Like our personal property. And so with respect to that, I think we're moving in the right direction. And that's why I see blockchain and Web3 being a panacea to a lot of the ails that we have in our current society, and sort of how capitalism is breaking down. I hope that the sort of decentralized nature of Web3 can help provide a new alternative and a better direction for us to move forward in the future.
That's a great response on the fly. Well done, Trevor. Okay, last little spitball question I've been thinking about is, someone on Twitter brought up, they were getting in fights with Bitcoin maxis, and they were talking about tokens are kind of like proxy equity. And that idea is fascinating, where it's like equity is this idea that you can put in money and you get a percentage of a business, but there's like securities laws and there's accredited investor laws, and it feels very archaic. It feels unattainable to someone like me at my stage. But tokens feel much more transparent, democratic in some sense, accessible. How do you think about this idea of like tokens are kind of proxy equity?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think as well. I think that the closest analogy to tokens is a form of equity. And it represents it should represent an ownership share over an open source protocol. And so I think of tokens as like decentralized equity, because it's only not a security if it's decentralized. So by that nature, a token must be decentralized equity in order for it not to be a security. And so there's many open source. Open source has a long history well before blockchain. If you look at Stacks, Ethereum, et cetera, they're all open source. And that's what makes it not a security, is that there's multiple different companies and stakeholders. You're not dependent on any one company to grow the thing. And so that's what makes it a proxy of equity or a decentralized form of equity. And that is super exciting, because it allows it to, like you said, be approachable for everyone. You know what I'm saying? And it allows it to be transparent, accountable, and open to the world. So, you know, I think that, you know, we're moving towards a world where we don't need all these institutions to oversee things. We have the skills and the tools to do it ourselves.
I think tokens are decentralized equity might be the bar of the episode. Like, that's a t-shirt, that's a bumper sticker. That's so succinct. I love that. Okay, last question. I like to end on a high note. So thinking like forward looking. So I'm imagining like you can do whatever you want. Maybe you're staying at Stacks Ventures, crushing it, and you're executing just like perfectly. Like all guns blazing, things are going smoothly. What do you see yourself in 5 years? What does that like perfect dream Trevor look like 5 years from now?
Yeah. So my ultimate goal in life, like my dream in life, is to start an orphanage. So, you know, I love educating. I love helping other people. And so if I, you know, make the big bucks someday, what I'd want to do is I want to invest all in that and starting like ideally the world's biggest orphanage, because I'd want to allow, and this is going to be like a high tech like orphanage, like all the kids from this orphanage are going to go to Harvard, Stanford, or start their own, you know, schools that are better than Harvard or Stanford. And so, you know, just the ability to, you know, why I love working with early stage founders is because I can have such a big impact, right? Like I can take, we can take something that's like very moldable and make it, like I said, from one of many to one of a kind. And so the ability to, what I'm most interested in is like having the biggest impact possible on, you know, not like having a small impact on like a ton of people, but having a massive impact on a few people, to me is more satisfying. And that's kind of like what I did with my previous work at Lean Startup Machine. You know, like it was really like, about opening people's minds to a new way of thinking. And so to be able to do that with people who were given an unfair shake in life, and to be able to help not just put them on the right path, but put them on the high road, the first class, you know, path, is kind of like my dream and my ultimate goal, in my life. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. There's something about, you know, mindset's a cliche term that everyone kind of throws around, but like as someone who grew up very timid and shy, when I look at myself now, it's like a different person that I couldn't even fathom back then. And so even this podcast is kind of like that, where it's like, one, I'm pushing myself, but two, I'm trying to like hopefully inspire one or two people to listen to this episode and do that thing. So yeah, that sounds freaking incredible, dude. So yeah, that's great.
Yeah, man. Well, that's why people love watching your podcast, dude, because people know that you're just approaching it from such a genuine perspective. And I remember when I first saw you like recording on Twitter, I forget where I first saw you, but I was like, you know, super excited and jazzed about that you're, you know, starting this podcast. And I'm just like so grateful to you to see how far you've come and how much effort you've put into supporting the Stacks ecosystem. So, you know, hats off to you, Jake, for all that you've done.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It means a lot. Okay. Not even last question. Let's just close this out. This has been a fantastic conversation. If people want to learn more about you, you have a super strong Twitter handle, but yeah, if they want to follow you or they want to get involved and maybe learn more about Stacks Ventures, where's the places to go?
Yeah. So follow me at TO on Twitter, just two letters at TO, and then check out at Stacks Startups. So it's at Stacks Startups, two S's in the middle. And we're also stacksventures.io, stacks.ac for the accelerator. And of course, make sure you're following Stacks. Yeah, we'll have our next cohort coming out towards the end of this year. So we'll be launching applications soon. If you want to be a part of building, you know, the next internet on top of Bitcoin and the new digital economy on top of Bitcoin, this is the best place to build. It's an amazing community. And I think that the advantages of the technology are far superior to anything else out there.
Perfect. All right. I think that's a fantastic way to end it. Let me not say it. No more words. Trevor, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, my man.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Welcome to Built on Bitcoin.
I know that things don't always go your way, but I'll be right here waiting.
I've been waiting now, I've been trying to figure out a way to make it out, cause I don't think about everything going wrong.